The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Good morning and welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson, and today our guests are from Rediscover. We have the CEO, Alan Flory, and Vice President of Clinical Services, Lauren Moyer. Good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations.
Thank you for having us.
So can you tell the listeners, what is Rediscover?
Rediscover, we call it a community mental health. We're a community mental health center. We provide mental health services and we provide substance use disorder treatment services, and through all of Jackson County.
Before we really get started today, I want to dedicate this show to my sister. Her name was Sharon Jackson. She passed away last year, and she struggled lifelong with mental health. And a lot of people don't know that they see mental health as a stigma. But with proper care and treatment, people that suffer with mental health disorders can lead a normal, healthy, and productive life. She was a kindergarten teacher, and she did a lot. In some cases, it's just as about getting the help and treatment that they need and getting the medications and recognizing the triggers that will, in some cases, put them into a situation where they will need just a little bit of additional care to get them back on that particular path to where they're back in a situation where they're good at and on the path again. So what type of services does Rediscover provide for those in the community?
So we provide an array of services from medication services, outpatient therapy services, to your more intensive services. So for folks who are suffering from bipolar and having that severe and persistent mental illness, we offer case management support to where we can go to their home, go into their community, and help them really get equipped with the services that they need. If they need to get on Medicaid, if they need to go back to work, if they need help getting their birth certificate or their ID or getting help filling their medications, we offer that support. If someone's struggling with substance use and, you know, they really want to try to get off of that and restore hope to their life, we offer both a residential service where they can come, up to 27 days, and or an outpatient service to where they can continue to get group therapy or individual therapy, as well as medication if that's needed. We also offer more intensive outreach services for folks who may not be ready to change just right now, but they are utilizing our more costly resources in the community, such as constantly getting into contact with the police or constantly going to the emergency room instead of actually getting connected to an outpatient service. We have outreach workers that really meet them where they're at and try to elicit some type of motivation to do something different. Usually that's helping them, you know, get their basic needs met, and so they'll start there.
One of the services that's listed on your website is a mental health court. Can you explain to our listeners what that is and how that impacts and helps those that are suffering with mental health challenges?
Yes, so mental health court is a diversion court program. So it's for individuals who are 18 and up who suffer from mental health and substance use issues. For this type of service, we realize that chronically going back to jail is not likely a useful intervention for folks that are struggling with a severe and persistent mental illness, such as bipolar or schizophrenia. A lot of times people will get off their medication, and in a manic phase, they may go steal something from the grocery store and really not understand what they were doing at the time. So what mental health court is geared towards is for folks who have those low-class felonies or misdemeanor charges, who really are going to be, that's going to be a barrier for them moving forward. And so if they work the program, which can last anywhere from 6 months to a year, as long as they kind of follow treatment recommendations and get connected to outpatient care, those charges will then be dismissed.
And that is definite, because I know sometimes when it gets cold and those that may be homeless may break a window just to be able to get into a warm place and a safe place in the wintertime. So, and then they're not realizing they're looking at trying to get someplace safe and warm for the winter, but breaking that window, and there are other places in the community where they can go. You know, the shelters may be full, but there's places where they can go to get that help that they need.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to look at putting a dollar amount to the challenges that we have on a yearly basis for care and treatment in the metropolitan area, what would we be looking at?
Well, the cost is certainly millions. And I'm thinking of the cost of not doing anything is multi-millions, both for the community. But you think of an individual or a family, the cost of not getting a good education because your mental health problems are impacting your ability to learn. People who are unable to hold a job or do well on the job, that cost is huge. We see a lot of people that are what they call frequent flyers in hospital emergency rooms, and the cost of those hospitals, because those emergency room costs are huge, a few thousand dollars per person. And we see hundreds of those people who frequent emergency rooms multiple times a month, sometimes multiple times a week, and saving that money for the hospitals, for instance. So you start adding that up, and it's millions and millions of dollars locally in terms of the cost of not providing care.
Well, it's also, I know emergency rooms, bed space can be at a premium, and in the hospital, they may have enough challenges, and they're always complaining about staff, so it's having that staff that's on call to be able to do with that person, so that's also probably another challenge they face, because they're going to probably have to call somebody that's going to be able to have to sit with that person one-on-one, and then being able to find out that history, which makes it even more of a challenge for that hospital to be able to know how to treat that person. And in some cases, I bet they probably just end up putting them back out on the street because they don't know how to treat them. And if they're being not compliant, but they're not being compliant it's not because they don't want to be compliant. It's right now they're going through a phase and they can't be compliant.
Right. I mean, I think that the hospital just gets bombarded with several emergencies, and the emergency room isn't set up to deal with the long-term impact that those people are struggling with. They really need to get connected to that outpatient care.
So we're discussing your hospital diversion plan. How does that hospital diversion plan actually work?
So our hospital diversion program has been around since 2009. We started with a grant from the Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City, and based on the results from that, we were able to take it to the state level and actually replicate that model throughout eight areas in the state. So the whole premise of the hospital diversion program is to divert individuals who are chronically going back to the emergency room or getting admitted to an inpatient unit for their mental health and or substance use, and get them a different approach. It's a very non-traditional approach to care. So for folks that are chronically going back, we realize there's not this bridge to get them connected to that outpatient. They leave the hospital and they go back maybe that same day, maybe within the same hour. Days later, they get picked up by police, and it's just this chronic cycle. So what our hospital diversion outreach workers do is they meet them where they're at. If that's under a bridge, if that's in the emergency department, wherever that looks like. And a lot of these folks are struggling with just meeting their basic needs. So they may not have food, they may not have shoes on, you know, they may not have a source of housing that's stable. So these outreach case managers are just kind of focusing on that first, kind of that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We all kind of need our basic needs in order to get to that next step and so on and so forth. So the outreach workers just really break it down to simplicity and helping them with their basic needs. And then they talk about, well, let's talk about going to the outpatient treatment. Let's get you hooked up with a psychiatrist. But that comes later on. And we've seen huge success, so much so that folks that might have come in, you know, 20 visits in the last month, were able to decrease that by 75% to 80% within a 3-month time span.
So how long have you all been doing this wonderful work in our community, in our city?
We've been here 48 years. We started out as a group of volunteers, and we just keep growing, trying to meet all the needs, and we're still not close to meeting all the needs.
So that is almost 50 years of doing this type of wonderful work in the city, and while we may never be able to meet all the needs, we have to look at it from the aspect of what would happen if we weren't here meeting the needs that we are meeting.
Correct.
So we hear a lot about opioid epidemic in America. How large of a problem is that in the Kansas City metropolitan area?
It's certainly growing pretty rapidly. I saw, and I don't have the exact number, but I saw that Kansas City, Jackson County, has reached the top 5 of opioid deaths, overdose deaths in Missouri. St. Louis was always leading in that unfortunate statistic, and for quite a while, but now the Kansas City area has reached up there as well. It's a growing problem, definitely. Even 2 or 3 years ago, it was small, unnoticed. We have, in treatment right now, today, we have almost 500 people who have been addicted to opioids, and that we see them almost every day.
What can we do to lower the number of people in Kansas City who are addicted to opioids, but also begin to recognize the signs and symptoms of opioid abuse?
Well, one of the things that we don't have in the areas around Kansas City, and just got it just for Kansas City, is there's a prescription drug monitoring program that's everywhere in the nation, except for it's not in most of Missouri, where pharmacists or doctors, if somebody comes in and says, I need a pain pill, or lots of pain pills, that they could look them up before they give them a prescription and say, wait a minute, you've been doing this at 10 other places. And that would be something that would be very beneficial. And we do not, we just got it in Jackson County, but somebody could still go to Belton. Somebody could still go to Lexington or other places, you know, Warrensburg. They could still go outside of here and do that. So we'd like to see that shut down. The other thing would be to have continue and expand the cooperation with the police and treatment services to really divert people into treatment more quickly. We're working hard to try to respond as quickly as we can and get people in, ideally the same day, but certainly by the next day if we can get them into treatment. Because if you wait, because we have probably 100 people who would like to get in for treatment, and we don't have the capacity. So it's expanding. We're planning on expanding that capacity over the next year so we can respond very quickly.
So it seems like people, it's kind of when we had a lot of great Hollywood actors and singers that basically they prescription shop, but here it seems like, you know, the boundaries of the city or the county are just boundaries, because now once I pass those boundaries, I can now get another doctor to issue me another prescription, and those boundaries need to be expanded to statewide. But we're so close to the border, shouldn't it be a national registry? Because if you expand it just to Kansas City and to Missouri, but now I can drive right across where we're a mile, 2 miles to Kansas. I can drive across to Kansas, and then I can get those same prescription medications in Kansas. So shouldn't it be a national ride registry where you can then look at me and see where doctors I may have gotten from across the nation?
Yes, it should be national. In fact, it is national except for Missouri. And what happened was Missouri wouldn't pass it, wouldn't join it, so Jackson County agreed to join it. So what we need, and so we're fortunate, amazingly, as a Missouri resident, Kansas actually did something good before we did. So
it's like we Missouri refused to expand Medicare and Medicaid expansion, so now we also, since we refused to do the opioid database, we're now in the top five of the state. So it seems like in ways in which we refuse to act, it also begins to have a negative impact on our state, but also it impacts our state economy because people who are addicted to opioids can't go to work, can't hold down a job, you know, and be as productive as they would have been had they not been on the opioids.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think a lot, from a preventative standpoint, if more of our folks could get on board with just the education behind it, restricting how many they give to folks. We have a lot of people that get 2 and 3 refills on the same medication that perhaps maybe they only needed for 7 days. And just understanding pain tolerance and, you know, just being a little bit more educated about the responses to the medication and how quickly you can become addicted to it is critical.
And I know sometimes the doctor wants to be nice and save you a doctor's visit back, but, you know, instead of putting 3 refills on there, have you call back in to get those refills and have those refills then sent to the pharmacy instead of automatically putting the 3 refills on there, you know, have you call back in to get them because, you know, if I'm feeling unwell, I may be able to go to a leave or something a little bit lower that I don't have to pay that copay for, you know, or I may be able to go down to, instead of Tylenol 3 with I may be able to go to Tylenol 3 with codeine instead of the one that's above that. So there's a couple of different remedies that maybe could otherwise be put in place. We know that mental health used to carry such a negative stigma with it. But help with individuals that have, but with help, they can have a normal life. How important is it to be able to recognize when a person is having a mental health crisis?
I think it's very important. A lot of times, right now, we're dealing with an increase that we're seeing with deaths by suicide. And so for us to educate the public, for us to educate our first responders in, one, just building rapport with an individual so that someone has a natural support system to talk to is critically important for all of us. You know, we all want relationships and having those basic relationships. And so making sure that we're fostering that within our community is huge. You know, asking people, how are you today? Can very much change someone who's actively thinking of taking their life to actually thinking, wow, someone cares. So it's the very small things as a community that first responders can do. And then educating yourself about your loved one's symptoms, about what triggers them. You know, a large percentage of our population deals with some type of mental health issue. Obviously, severity will differ between individuals, but recognizing that everyone needs a natural support and being okay with talking about it is what people need from people.
I know about a month ago, we had the young lady at the high school who committed suicide, and, you know, Thanksgiving, the holiday season, a lot of people begin to feel like they are lonely, and Thanksgiving Day, I had a lady on whose husband was a police officer who committed suicide. And, you know, did a ride along with the police officers, some of the things that they see, they have the toughest job in the city. They have to put aside their personal problems to come and deal with the problems across the city, from shootings to domestic violence. Then they have to, at the end of a 10-hour shift, drop all of that and then go back home and begin to deal with their problems. But in the midst of dealing with some of our problems, then they're being texted by their wives, sometimes called by their children and all those different things. And it creates an enormous stress that people just don't see unless you're actually out there. One of the things that stuck with me from the ride along, we went and it was two officers and they responded to something at the old Sam's on 40 Highway. And they got out there and it was 12 people and two officers. And they were like, they told me, stay in the car. We don't need another person to have to worry about. And, you know, they said, we've got to secure the scene just for our safety first. So there's a lot that goes on just in that job. You know, so I definitely commend them for the job in which they do. Mm-hmm. Having went through mental health and first aid, and that was something that I went through when I was on the school board. And then I found out that there was a child version of that. But mental health first aid teaches that participants have a five-step action plan. It's called a G, which is to support a loved one, colleague, neighbors, and others experiencing a mental health substance abuse problem with an emotional crisis. Assess for risk of suicide or harm. Listen non-judgmentally. Give reassurance and information. Encourage appropriate professional help. Encourage self-help and other support strategies that person may have that works for them. So let them know that you care. Make sure that they're not going to be a threat to themselves. But most of all, listen, because if you listen, they will tell you what's going on, what's wrong. And then that lets you know that lets them know that you care when you're listening by your responses to them, but also that encourage them to get the help for things they're expressing to you. But then at that point in time, that can just say, as you said, that one act of helping them and listening can stop them from doing something else down the road. And in some cases, as you said, it just takes us having that, how are you doing this morning? You know, did you have a good evening? Just those one simple words can stop somebody sometimes from doing something. And I've talked to people who said, you know, sometimes, you know, somebody said something to me and it was just that one thing that stopped me from hurting myself or hurting somebody else. So, you know, you're thinking about it as you think about, you know, when my children used to come on my first thing I asked them, how was your day? Mm-hmm. Because you let them know that you cared. When I was in the military, no matter how bad my day was, we had a little green wagon and I would take the wagon and we'd go around. It was my way of getting exercise. I would walk. I would pull them around base, and we'd talk about their day, and I'd talk about my day, and they would always know, well, Daddy cared, because Daddy would ask me how my day was. So, you know, mm-hmm. when they got older and we had more children, somebody had to walk. So, but they always knew that we cared, and then we would go walk. And then when they got older and everybody was out the wagon, we would go to the track and go walk, but it was still my way of checking in mm-hmm. and seeing how they were doing. So now it's more they're older, and so now we text, and so it's a different generation, but you definitely have to just kind of also always check in and kind of go from there. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's critical. And most of the people who've taken, who've died by suicide by a gun or jumping off of a bridge, 70% of those individuals decided that within an hour or less. And so it's very critical that anyone in their life just listen and be supportive and ask you how you are.
So as we start to wind down, where are your facilities located for those who may be having a crisis or knowing someone that is maybe possibly experiencing a crisis and needs help?
So we have several different locations, but if someone would like to start our services, they can call 816-966-0900, or Monday through Friday they can walk in to our location in Lee Summit, which is 1535 Northeast Rice Road in Lee Summit, Missouri, and that's 64086. Or we have one in South Kansas City, which is 8800 Blue Ridge Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. And so we do offer a walk-in, or they can call us, and we can figure it out. We can help what they're with whatever the issue might be. So if that's coming in and actually getting treatment for us, or us helping them get connected to someplace closer to them, whatever that might look like, that would be the first step.
Do you have a website so if people wanted to learn more about your organization and the type of services you provide, that they can go on and read about your organization?
Sure. It's rediscovermh.org. So rediscovermh.org.
And if someone has a loved one that's experienced a mental health crisis or needs substance abuse counseling and treatment, what is the first step that they should do?
And you said if a loved one has it? I think the first step for them, because a lot of times, depending upon where they're at, like how long it's been that they've been dealing with this with their loved one, they might feel very stressed. They might want to force their loved one into treatment. What I would suggest is just calling us and allowing us to maybe speak with that loved one and kind of meet them where they're at. Because a lot of times when people tell you what to do, I think we can all say, we want to say, well, no, we're not going to do that. So instead of being faced with constant pushback, in our field, we do have skill set to help elicit motivation in folks. And so what I always try to tell family members or friends of folks is just listen, actively listen, support them, and just keep giving them our information to reach out. Or reach out to us, and we can reach out to them.
But also, I want to remind people this, that in Kansas City, we have specially trained officers that are called CIT, Crisis Intervention Trained Officers, that if you have to call the police to your home, request that they send out a Crisis Intervention Trained Officer. And I know one of Chief Smith's new initiatives is he wants to ensure that all of the officers are CIT trained, because they have, I think it's an additional 40 hours on top of their training, that they're recognized that situations, and that they are they will try to talk people down to get them the help that they need, instead of a situation ending in some cases with a negative outcome. So if you have to call the police and it's a mental health emergency, definitely ask for a CIT officer, because in some cases it's called suicide by police officers. Some people can't take the lives themselves, but they may come out with a weapon. It happened up north. An individual came out with a samurai sword. He didn't want to hurt the officer, but he wanted the officer to end his life. And so those that are CIT trained can recognize those things and kind of go from there. But in some cases, it can't be helped. I know there was a case in St. Louis where there's an individual who was shot, but he had mental health illnesses, but they didn't have the CIT program like they have here in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
One last question. It's probably the dinosaur in the room. We'll have to probably have you come back and talk about this next year in a different... What is the impact of trauma on our everyday lives?
Oh, it's such a huge impact. I think you spoke to the fact that we have initial trauma, but we also have secondary trauma. The police are suffering from that. The helping professional individuals suffer from that. In some aspect, trauma touches all of us. And so as an agency, we have really tried to become more trauma responsive and trauma informed. And that's a lot to do with the approaches we take of meeting individuals where they're at, and recognizing and providing grace to individuals for their situation and their background and their experience that has occurred.
Yeah, we're noticing that the vast majority of the people that we're seeing for mental health services or substance use services experienced chronic trauma, repeated trauma in their life.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on CalTime Conversations today and help me impart some very much needed information for our community. We're never in CalTime Conversations without our community minute. Today marks the 76th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. More than 2,400 American soldiers and civilians were killed during this attack, and another 1,000 were wounded. Nearly 20 American naval vessels were destroyed in the attack, including 8 massive battleships, and more than 300 airplanes were lost. Many of those who were serving in our armed forces on that day have passed, and only a few are still with us. The freedom and rights we enjoy as Americans are bought and paid for with a sacrifice and a price. Please remember that each day, and when you see an active duty service member, veteran, or member of our National Guard, say thank you for the service. Join us next week on Cowtown Conversations when we will have representatives from KU, and we'll be talking about a new grant that's aimed to help curb violence in teens. So for Cowtown Conversations, I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Tune in next week for another episode.